about the beauty of the mind. She initially had a certain topic area that she wanted me to speak about, and I thought probably the title itself would be a bit boring, so we just decided to change to something a bit more abstract, so we decided to call it the beauty of the mind. Now when we talk about the beauty of the mind, we're talking about the positive qualities of the mind. And I think just to help me gauge the different ideas and where different perspectives you're coming from arriving in this talk, we'll just do a short brainstorm session. I'll get each of you, in fact, I'll just ask Rosie to pass out these very soon, on these post-it notes, right? When we think of qualities of the mind, think of what are the things, what are the qualities that you think will be considered something that is representative of the beauty of the mind. What are the qualities? It could be love, it could be compassion, or whatever it is. What is it that you think is something that you would consider to be a quality, a positive, a good quality of the mind, something that is the beauty of the mind? Right? There are no right or wrong answers. This is just brainstorming. So get Rosie and probably someone to help you to pass these out. If you need pen, just write it on. You can use your own pen, or there are plenty of pens around. You can probably help them pass out the pen.
Wow.
And when you're done, just pass it up, and then we'll paste it on the board and see what we have. You can use more than one piece of paper, doesn't matter. Enough pens. Pens.
Does it have to be one or more than one?
If more than one, just put on different pieces of paper. Yeah. One quality or one piece of paper. So if you have a few qualities to think of, you can put it on various pieces of paper, then we'll have a look. Just write it large if you can, so that people could see when I put it on the board. And there's some more pens here.
Can I collect it?
Yeah. Yeah, if you're ready, you just put your hands up, then Rosie will collect that from you. Or you can come up to the... honesty, politeness. Okay, we got honesty, we got politeness. Okay, keep them coming. Getting out from anxiety. Concentration. Concentration. Knowledge. Kindness. Mindfulness. Empathy. Able to keep a perspective. Tranquility. Complexity, determination.
Wow, cool. Thank you.
Okay. You see, by doing this, I don't even need to give the talk anymore. You guys are covered. So I'll just quickly go through what we have here on the board. So we have light or heavy and change. Who is the one who put this one up? Yep. What do you mean by light and heavy and change? And
there are moments when sometimes your mind is so clear and you feel the lightness, and there are times when it feels really heavy and there's so much going through.
Okay. All right. Good. Light and heavy and change. I'll put it here for now. Alright, and then we got wisdom, memory, complexity. Now memory and complexity seem to be from the same person. Who wrote this one? Yep. What do you mean by complexity?
Well, I'm just thinking of brain is made up of like all the cells and nerves and things like that. Mm. So it's how amazing that all this can generate our emotions, you know, like thinking and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. Okay, and then the memory is also the capacity of the brain to process these things. And that's great. We've got a few mindfulness here. Mindfulness, determination, knowledge. Who was the person who wrote knowledge? It's trying to sue. What were you thinking of when you're thinking knowledge?
Specifically, we were able to get a lot of different...
understanding that helps you in a way rearrange your world and whatnot and look out and make it work for you. So it's a bit like wisdom, alright? That's good. Purity, we've got mindfulness, wisdom, ability to think. Goes back to also our mental capacity. Penetration as seeing. Who was the person who wrote penetration as seeing? What do you mean by that when you were thinking of that?
Your ability to concentrate and cut through things.
So, yep.
Cut through illusion and delusion.
Okay, so the ability to penetrate. Clarity of seeing. Okay, thank you for that. That's good. And we got this cluster, which is like kindness, metta, loving kindness, and there's some generosity, honesty, politeness, and then ability to give and receive love. That's important. Gratitude. Right, I see some books out there, gratitude to parents, so that's good. Then we got forgiveness, a lot of compassion, a lot of empathy, ability to, I guess, when you're saying empathy, what were you getting at? Who were the people who were writing empathy?
The ability to be able to put your place in the position of the other, not just yourself, but to be able to understand that the other yourself as well.
Yep. Okay. So ability to almost like put yourself in the other person's perspective. So feeling what they're going through, understanding what's going on for them. Okay. The other person who wrote empathy? Yep.
Yeah, it was roughly the same idea. Mm-hmm. The ability to put yourself in other people's shoes, mm-hmm. from other people's perspective, not just your own.
Okay, so not just your self-centeredness, being able to look at things from other people's perspective. I think that's great. Altruism? Yep.
Doing good without expecting anything back.
Okay, alright. Doing good without expecting anything in return. Altruism, that's great. And on this side, we've got conscience, ability to reason, and conscience. Who gave us this one? Yep. Can you elaborate a bit on what you were thinking when you're looking at ability to reason and your conscience?
Yeah, so ability to reason means that whatever the actions that you do, you can reason about the reasons why. Just question why you're doing those actions. Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like an insight and awareness of what's happening. Okay. And is that the same concept as conscience there?
No, not really. I was trying to put two concepts.
Okay. All right. And by conscience, what were you trying to get at?
Just conscience as in thinking that something is reasoning whether something's good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not good.
Okay. Bad. All right. Okay, I'll put this here. Yep. Okay. And then we've got getting out from anxiety. Yes, it's very important for us. Okay, this falls. Getting out from anxiety, I think that's very important, and that's where a lot of my research is looking at, using certain Buddhist principles, which I'll talk about soon. Apologize for that. I'll leave that there. Using that to learn to deal off with our worrying mind, the anxiety that keeps going on in our mind. That's where a lot of my work is at the moment. Then you've got concentration. It's important to have concentration. Equanimity, the balance of the mind. That goes back to ability to deal with changes, the changes in the mind frames, even the sad and the bad things. So who was the one who wrote this, even the sad and bad things? Yes, Linus, what were you thinking when you were...
Sad and the bad things that after you experience them, you can learn through them, and then mm-hmm. you have a better understanding of yourself and life.
Mm.
Yeah, and then you can proceed and evolve.
I see. Yeah. Okay, so being able to almost use the adversities in life and using that as a learning experience and going through that, yeah, I think that's important. Then we've got, of course, sympathetic loving. Who was the person who wrote this? Sympathetic loving? Yep. Again, what were you? I'm just checking in. Sympathetic. By what do you mean by sympathetic loving?
Just being able to sympathize if someone is having trouble
mm-hmm.
or suffering.
Okay. All right. Ability to sympathize and love. Okay, I think that's great. And that's related also to a sense of tolerance. Okay, understanding and sort of coexisting. We've got happiness, tranquility, very important. Sympathetic joy. With sympathetic joy, who was the person who wrote sympathetic joy? Yes. What were you thinking about when you think
just
of
just when you see happy people, your ability to be happy for them. You know, so no matter who in the world, there's people that are doing great things, and your ability to tune into that greatness and just be as happy as they are.
Mm.
Just, you know, it's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, it is. It is. Thank you for that. So yeah, we've sort of brainstormed different aspects of the way we look at the beauty of the mind. So. The way I've sort of clustered this, I know in a very simple manner, is to look at it in sort of different clusters that are sort of related to each other. So on the one hand, we have this clarity of the mind, understanding the workings and intricacies of the mind, ability to look deep into different things, and there's an aspect of loving, caring, loving nature of things, and there's ability to take other people's perspective. Being able to understand, tolerate, and include others. So there's that cluster. And there's that ability to hold that balance of the mind, equanimity, that balance, and being able to sort of deal with the changes, right? The light and the heavy, going through their changes, ability to handle that. And also just purely that happiness, that sense of happiness, joy for yourself or for other people. So this is how I sort of conceptualize it. And yeah, pretty much that's the talk. Thank you all. I think this is really this is a very good start, and I really didn't know what to expect when when we set this topic initially, because Rosie wanted me to talk about the what we call the four immeasurables, or the four Brahma Viharas in Buddhism. Some of you may be relatively familiar with this. Some of you, this may be relatively new. So there are four positive qualities that is mentioned in the Buddhist tradition over and over again. Right? These four qualities, they say, the Buddha said, loving-kindness. Right? Loving-kindness is not an English word. It's sort of, you know, sometimes Buddhists use these words in such a casual manner, they almost forget that it's not a real word. Loving-kindness is like, do you mean loving or do you mean kindness? Right? It's sort of, the traditional word is metta. Right? The Indian word for it is metta. And it encompasses a loving nature in a very gentle and kind way. So that's why I guess initially when the scholars came across this word in the Indian Pali text or the Sanskrit text, they found it difficult to translate because they didn't want to, I guess, use just love, because people may get confused with that over sense of attraction or that strong sense of emotion that's associated with love. Because it's not entirely that. It is a unconditional giving and offering of that generosity, that care, that kindness. So I guess that's why they probably had a huge discussion. I'm just speculating at this point. But then they decided to call it loving kindness, which captures both sides of it. A very loving side and very kind and gentle side. So that's the first one. The second one, compassion. Right? Traditional words, karuna. Compassion. That means ability to feel for other people. Like empathy, compassion, that. Right? The third one, right? Sympathetic joy. The joy for others. When other people have things going well for them, that feeling of joy, as you've correctly said, Peter, is it? Yeah, as Peter had very rightfully mentioned just now, when other people are experiencing joy, you're feeling that joy for them, that sympathetic joy. And the fourth one is equanimity, right? That balanced state of mind. And I guess very often you'll hear loving kindness and compassion in the Buddhist circles. Right? It is a very, very something that defines a lot of Buddhist practice. Loving kindness, compassion. Right? When people come across the Dalai Lama, one of the descriptions that they say is such a loving and compassionate being. Right? As these words again are used a lot in Buddhist practice, Buddhist circles and Buddhist terminology. So these are the four things that the Buddha said. These are what are called the four immeasurable states of the mind, or the four noble states of the mind. And this is what the talk tonight will be about, right? And I assume no one else has spoken about this yet. Okay. But everyone seems to have, if you put everyone's idea together, there is that aspect. And there's also a aspect on the side, we're talking about mindfulness, wisdom. And I think, from my perspective, it was... As we go on in the night, I'll try to bring these two together, right? On the one hand, you've got the traditions of the wisdom traditions. These are the traditions of the ones relating to other people, right? So if you can look at it, there are two aspects of Dharma practice, of Buddhist practice. One of them is looking within ourselves, the journey inwards. But because we don't live by ourselves, right, we have interactions with other people. Right, whether minimally or in a lot of day-to-day life. This is important. This aspect of loving, compassion, relating to others, these are the skills and the tools that we need to have when we are going outwards, when we are dealing in and out with different people. And this is another set of skills that is important for us to look within. And tonight, what I'm going to discuss is bringing these two things together. In a lot of different practices, when we talk about these four immeasurables, I'll just write them up. There are various translations. Some of them call it four noble states of the mind. Some call it the four immeasurables. That means it's limitless. The strength of it, the ability of it to reach outwards is immeasurable, right? Its capacity is immeasurable. That's why some translations call it four immeasurables. The traditional is Brahma Vihara. right? Brahma is the highest being. Vihara is where that being resides. So it's a state of the mind of the highest being. So that's why we call it the noble states of the mind. Now, in a lot of Buddhist practices, a lot of Buddhist tradition, people often say you need to be kind towards others. You need to have compassion towards others. Right? When other people are having happiness, you should feel for them as well. Right? And with equanimity, whatever happens out there, you should feel calm and collected. Right? That is very important. Looking at loving kindness, the first one. Kindness is important. From the smallest level of kindness, being able to even have eye contact with a person, just that smile, right? That changes how people interact, the dynamics between different people. Right? Kindness could be something very small to something big. Right? Some people risk their lives to save other people. Right? Usually during times of a lot of difficulties, people rise to the occasion. They do a lot of selfless acts, a lot of giving, a lot of generous acts, right? Sometimes putting their lives in danger. That is kindness. And that is a very important thing that's always been reinforced in Buddhist teachings. Another aspect of it, in order to have kindness, it comes together with compassion. You cannot really have kindness unless you feel for the other person. You feel for the pain of the other person. That's why loving kindness and compassion often goes hand in hand. Certain traditions call this loving kindness, compassion, with a hyphen in the center. It's almost like two concepts blended together. Ability to understand that other people are suffering, and therefore you're offering your help, offering your kindness towards others. And this is a very important part of our practice of how we relate to other people. This is a very important training ground for us as we go in and out of daily life to understand that it's not just about me. Other people. We always think that we are the center of the entire universe, whether we want to admit it or not. Right? I'm the center of my universe. It is ability for a while to say that, okay, other people think that they are the center of their universe too. And they have their issues, they have their troubles, they have their difficulties to see. And therefore they have suffering, they have pain. And therefore I'm showing kindness. It's this ability. Right? Looking at joy, again, it's relating to other people. In a community, right? Sometimes it's not just bad things happen, good things happen to you or to other people. And when other people are experiencing happiness, instead of sometimes feeling jealous or like, why is it not me? We are encouraged to feel that joy and happiness towards other people's happiness. And the last one again, equanimity, the balance of the mind. No matter what happens, life goes up, life comes down. Life goes up again, comes down, goes up and down. It's a bit of an up and down graph, right? It's hard to predict, really. That is just the reality of life. And despite all these changes, all these ups and downs that are going through around us, we maintain a stability of the mind. We remain calm, right? We remain okay in that sense. And that is something, again, that's very much encouraged in the practice of Dharma or the practice of the Buddha's teaching. When I initially came across this concept, I found that this is very powerful. It is something of an ideal that we all need to try to work towards. And I tried for many, many years, right? I have these things, I have to be kind towards others, compassionate, have joy for others, and have calmness of the mind. It became an ideal that I constantly remind myself to cultivate. Right? Every time you come across someone, right, someone makes you unhappy, that's, it's alright, okay? The person has their problems, show kindness. Right? You sort of ask yourself to cultivate these type of habits, right? And this is a way of using this as a pathway of practice. When you're interacting with other people, different opportunities come up, and you keep changing your old habitual patterns. But then sometimes I find that because of these standards, it makes life quite difficult if you don't have the full picture. I'll clarify what I mean by that. Sometimes people try to be good Buddhists. Right? Good Buddhists. And they say that, oh, I should be kind towards others. Shouldn't get angry. Right? I should be compassionate towards others. Oh, other people are feeling joy. I'm not feeling joy for them. I'm feeling, in fact, quite jealous. I push that away. I need to try to feel joy. Right? So they push a lot of their negative habitual patterns away. Right? It's almost like you have an idea to live towards, and then you keep sort of pressuring, pushing yourself in that direction. In the short term, it works. Right? In the short term, it does work. But after a while, you find that, I don't think it fits entirely well. Or in the long run, you sort of become, you have burnout. Right? Sometimes people involve themselves in certain organizations, do a lot of group work or charity work, aid work, right? And ultimately, they burn themselves out. They can't sustain their kindness. They can't sustain their compassion and all these qualities. And what's going on here? What is going wrong there? Maybe some of you have experienced that before. Maybe some of you will experience that in the future. Right? And like I say, all these practice for kindness, showing compassion, all that, it's very common in Buddhist practice. And it's very encouraged. I strongly encourage that practice myself. But to take it a step further, we need to understand the intricacies of it. When you take one aspect of Dharma, one aspect of the Buddha's teachings, and you forget what else is important, and when you try to force yourself into that mold, and you can't, and you find that, I feel that I'm a bit fake here. I can try to ask myself to do all these things, but ultimately I don't feel that way. If there are times whereby you feel this sort of this conflict within, then it shows that there are other aspects of Dharma whereby you are starting to lose out. And that's why this aspect of it is important. Right? I'll start to integrate them as we go along. When we talk about the Brahma Vihara, the four immeasurables, right? These four things: love, kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. There's one, I can't remember the author's name, but a very famous traditional Buddhist scholar, right? When he wrote in one of his writings, he said that these four states of mind could be looked at from different perspectives. First of all, it could be seen as a pathway of practice. You use that to practice. You use that to remind yourself in the daily life to do all these things. All of us try to reach that. Right? So that's the first thing. The second is, when you're doing your mindfulness practice, purification of the mind, ultimately you reach a point whereby this comes very naturally. So it is a fruit of your practice. Okay? It's quite different. One is you begin trying to learn these things. The other one is you do all your mindfulness practice and it becomes a fruit of it. The third perspective is trying to bring these two things together. Right? Why? What is the Buddha's teaching for? Yeah. We have to be quite sure of why we are here. Why do we learn Dharma? What is the Buddha's teaching for?
Relieving suffering of yourself and others.
Yes, relieving suffering of yourself and others.
To purify our mind.
Purify of our mind. Purify our mind from what? What are the things that are purifying our mind from?
Defilements.
Okay. The tendencies of greed, the tendencies of hatred or aversion, or this sense of delusion, not seeing things as they really are. The Buddha gave us Dhamma, his teachings. Right? And he said that it's important for you to look into your life and see that we all have difficulties, troubles, problems. Those are the real things in life. Suffering is real, he said. Right? In life, all of us have our ups and downs, have our difficulties. It is important for us to understand how these difficulties come about. When we understand what causes these problems, then we can find a way to come out of it. And then he gave a systematic structure of how to get out of this. Right? I think probably last year or the week before, one of the monks covered the Four Noble Truths. This is what is central to his teaching. His objective, his aim, was to help us come out of the difficulties that we have in day in, day out. in our daily life, right? Sometimes we think of Nibbana as something that is out there and whatnot, but when you look at the Buddha's teaching, he was constantly helping people to come out of their pain, their suffering. That was why he was teaching Dhamma. And the way that he asks you to do that is to look into how these difficulties arise. What are these problems that we're experiencing? How do they come about? What causes it? If we understand what the cause is, take away the cause, suffering drops away. Right? This is in a gist what the Four Noble Truths is about. And when he came to the Fourth Noble Truth, when the actual training of it comes in, he says, what you have to do is the Eightfold Path. Right? The trainings of morality, live a good moral life. Alright, that's the basic. Don't harm other people, don't harm yourself. That's the basic. After that, you start to train the mind, the concentration, the power, the energy of the mind. Mastery over the mind. And with that mastery of the mind, then you start investigating into the nature of this body and mind. Suffering doesn't arise outside. If it does, we are doomed, right? We don't have control. Peace is beyond us. Happiness is beyond us. But the Buddha says suffering arises from this body and mind phenomena. And therefore, it is very important for each and every one of us to start understanding what is happening here at the body, at the mind level. And the way he said to do that is first live a moral life, ethical life. If you don't live an ethical life, you know, spirituality or happiness is a bit beyond you, right? Then train your mind, cultivate that strength of your mind. And using this strength of your mind, start investigating how the body works, how the mind works. When you come into contact with somebody, someone says something, travels in your head, into your ear. What happens? Why does this reaction come up? The Buddha said, see clearly for yourself how these patterns affect you. When something comes in, how it triggers out different things within you. And for that, he says, it's important for you to have a real understanding or wisdom into how the workings of the mind and body is. This was what his main teaching was about. Therefore, awareness, mindfulness, as some of you have rightly said, it's a very important aspect of the Buddhist teaching. It's one of the most fundamental aspects of cutting through, like that penetration, cutting through to actually what is happening. Why am I so upset? What pushes me? What makes me tick? What pushes my button? The Buddha wanted us to understand very clearly, seeing for ourselves in our own experience, direct experience, how these things happen. And then he gave very systematic training. First you do this, and then you do this, and how do you get there? Right? This is beyond our topic. But the main idea is, we have to be first very clear on why we are on this path. It is a path that helps you to achieve a life of peace and happiness. In order for us to do that, we have to see what are the obstacles of this peace and happiness, which is our pain and suffering. So the Buddha said, don't run away from your pain and suffering. That's why, first noble truth, there is difficulties. There are difficulties, there are issues here. Don't shy away from it. Use that and look into it, how it arises. When you understand how it arises, you know how to let that go. You know how to change your own life. And the way we approach that is through the Noble Eightfold Path. So clarity, awareness is very important. And this is what we call wisdom. What is wisdom? Wisdom is an understanding or seeing things as they truly are. Full honesty. No frills. Right? If I have difficulties, I have problems, I have anger, I'm seeing it as it is. To go beyond anger, one has to first understand what anger is. To go beyond our pain and suffering, we have to first understand what our pain and suffering is. That's why when I say this, if we use the four immeasurables as a pathway of practice, forgetting why we are here to begin with, that is where we get into a little bit of a sidetrack. We get a bit stuck, we get a bit lost. We have to constantly feel that we have to feel kindness, compassion for others. When anger arises, oh no, 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 shake that off. I have to be kind, I have to be compassionate towards others. Like I say, it works to a certain extent, but it doesn't sustain itself long term without a full practice of mindfulness and awareness. Does it make sense? Some of you may start to see how that has affected your life, how you've come across certain difficulties, when you find that the hardest people usually are the people closest to us, right, to show compassion. If they've done something wrong, if someone done something wrong, you don't really know them, ah, that's fine, you know, they have their issue, they have their problems, let's be kind to them, right? But if it's someone really near, then it's a very different story. Why is it that there's two different people doing the same thing having a different effect on you? This is how, through your practice of awareness, mindfulness, you see what comes up. If you're just forcing yourself, oh, I just need to be kind, I just need to feel compassion, and push away and deny your anger, your jealousy, pushing that away, you'll never really go beyond that. It's almost like grass is growing, put a huge brick on top of it, right? And one day when you remove the brick, when the conditions are right, the grass grows again. Right? The Buddha said, use that awareness, penetrative insight, to dig out these things and see what this anger is, what this greed, what this hatred is. And that is how we break free from delusion. That's how we break free with clarity, with awareness. If we're trying to force ourselves to be compassionate towards others without proper knowledge and awareness of what's happening inside, we are forcing ourselves to reach an ideal whereby we are not. That's why I say sometimes people fall into the trap of being so-called good Buddhists. Right? I get that too. Right? And sometimes, there was once I was supposed to go to a talk. Right? I was running late. And then there's traffic. As I was driving towards my talk, I was like, oh gosh, what's wrong with this traffic and whatnot. I was starting to have this anger come up. Right, I've got this anger and frustration. It's like, what is all these people doing here? It's like, oh, it's a Saturday, shouldn't be that much traffic, right? And here I am, was going to deliver a talk. I can't remember what the topic was, but probably about kindness or compassion. I can't remember. But in that process, I was like, oh, right. And that is being very honest about where I am, right? To see these things as they arise. It's like, oh, then the moment I realized, I caught myself. Okay, anger has arisen. Total honesty, awareness, with mindfulness. It's not that, oh, I shouldn't feel this way, I should push that away, I should show kindness. You can, but after a while, you'll still probably end up with even more tension. Right? We're not saying that we allow this anger to come out and have its free license to do whatever it wants, but to catch it, to see it for what it is. Once we're able to see it, then we can start to go beyond it. And that's important. And that is why insight, awareness and mindfulness is important. If I was in that car and keep on forcing myself, I should be kind, but yet I have this anger, it's like I'll have a lot of tension. Right? Then you will have, what will happen is, you will have one aspect of your life whereby you are very, very good, ideal Buddhist practitioner, and at the same time you have one side of you which is like, it's very irritable, very angry, and you are almost living two different types of life. In the monastery, you're like, oh, so kind, you know. Hello, auntie, how are you? After that, when you go outside, how come these people park here, you know? What happened to my shoes, right? Then there's like two aspects of you. If you don't start to integrate these two aspects, then your life becomes one aspect of you is normal functioning, and the other side of you, which is a very ideal self when you're trying to practice this. I'm not saying that kindness is bad, right? The reason why I'm not talking too much about that, I think everyone knows. Always when you go and ask people, or you tell other people, oh, someone asks, do you have any religion or any spiritual tradition? I say, oh, I'm a Buddhist. Oh yeah, Buddhists are so wonderful people. They're so kind and compassionate. I was like, well, not all the time. Right? If you're quite honest with yourself, you know that we do have anger. We do have judgment. And it's when we have judgment, we have this anger, we are very honest with ourselves. Anger has come up. Right? We're not denying it. We're not pushing it away. We're not giving it free license. We're watching it very closely, as the Buddha said. Watch clearly. What is it that causes your suffering? See it for what it is. And if you're able to continuously train yourself that, then you start to see, how it arises. From a bit, how does it become more and more? And by understanding this process of how it works, then only can we know what to take away, or what to do, or what not to do. If we go through life trying to live our ideals as the four immeasurables, trying to force the beauty of the mind without looking at the aspects of it which are not that beautiful, then it will just be a fake wrapping. When we are trying to force ourselves to look a certain way when we are not really there yet, then there's no point. If we're not clearing the garbage, we're just making it all beautiful from the outside. That's not ultimate. That's not going to sustain you for a long time. And that's why I see a lot of people fall into that trap, including myself in the past, whereby you're just working towards an ideal without proper understanding of what else is important on your journey, on your spiritual journey. How's that? Not yet. I'm just allowing you to sort of think of the different parts of how your practice comes together. What do you think Buddhism is about? To stop for a while to say, why are we here? What is it that we want to gain and achieve out of this? Only when we can start to be honest with ourselves, then can real kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity arise. Now, let's integrate the two together. Like I say, mindfulness awareness is very important, right? Without this awareness, sometimes we jump into things. We are trying to be kind towards others without really knowing what our intentions are. A lot of people are very passionate. They say, I want to do this, I want to do that. I want to go out and help save the world. That's all very good. That's all very noble. I don't question that. But look deep down inside. By doing that, are you running away from your own things that you don't want to face? Are we trying to chase against something as an ideal because we're trying to run away from something else? Without that mindfulness, that awareness, you won't see this happening at a deep level of your mind. You will just think, it's so good, I'm doing all these things, look at me. But there's so much ego behind that so-called kindness. And that's where people go wrong. And a lot of very so-called religious people, or very so-called try to be very nice people. I'm not saying everyone is, right? I always use myself as an example because I've been through that. You try to live a certain way, but when you stop and think, right, hang on, I think I may be just running away from my own vulnerabilities, my own difficulties. And if that is your motivation for kindness towards others, or by showing kindness towards others, I feel good that I can give kindness towards others, it's not about other people anymore. It's all about you. It's that self-centeredness starting to come up. Although it's very subtle, but you need to start to catch that. What is actually motivating you? When you're showing kindness, are you being very judgmental? What is the commentary that's going on in your head? Right, these are the things that you start to see. What is wrong? Compassion, empathy. I'm glad that someone mentioned empathy. The ability to take other people's perspective. If we are not comfortable with our own problems, our own anger, our own frustrations, our own issues, so to speak, how can we understand other people? You can't. That's right. Today I was at a workshop that talked about grief, right? Working with people with grief. I'm training as a clinical psychologist. So we're talking about grief. When people die, they go through a lot. Family members go through a lot of emotions, bereavement, right? And part of our work is to help support them in that respect, right? Allowing them to express their emotions and just sit with them and support them through that. That is a very difficult thing if you're not very comfortable with your own sense of loss, right? How can you support others when you yourself are wobbling? How can you understand how other people, what other people are going through if you don't really understand what's going on within yourself? you can't have compassion or real compassion for other people unless you are comfortable and working through your own difficulties. It doesn't mean that we have to be perfect to start reaching out. But at least work is in progress within. You're looking within. You're exploring, you're understanding what are these emotions. If you're able to be comfortable with that, then we can hold other people when they're distressed, when they're in that type of situation. Now that is real compassion. Sometimes people say, I have so much compassion. You cry, I cry, everyone cry. Right? You hold me, I hold you. It goes on in a huge circle. It doesn't mean that we don't become emotional anymore, but because we have worked through it, as much as you work through your own things, right? With your own anger, your own greed, your own hatred, your own jealousy, disappointment, all these things, all the different habitual patterns that get people stuck in difficulty, when you can work through your own these things, all your own issues, then you can start to hold other people. One of the things that people say when someone has passed away, right? They usually say, other people usually tell them, oh, it's going to be alright, you know, time will heal, right? And then one of these people we saw on as a case study, the person said, I wonder why they say this. Is it because they're not comfortable with how I'm expressing my grief? That's why they're almost like, you're starting to unpack your grief out. They're like, oh, it's okay, just pack back and like, you know, wrap it up for you. You'll be fine, you know. Because they can't handle this. They find it difficult, oh, awkward. What should I say at this point? It's like, should I say it's okay? Should I just keep quiet? Because of this uncertainty, right? As you're trying to unpack them, you quickly pack them and send them away. It's only when we are able to unpack ourselves, our emotions, our feelings, our ups and downs. Then when other people do the same, or if life circumstances pushes the other person to open up certain parts of themselves, then we can say, it's okay. Then we can really look the person in the eye and say that, it's okay, I'm here. Like I say, we all don't need to be perfect, but at least we are looking in that perspective, looking in that area of our lives. Without doing that, if you're going out to try helping people to be compassionate and whatnot, you will do long-term, medium-term, yes. Long term, you find it difficult. It's overwhelming. Oh no, this is too much for me. Some of you may have felt this before when trying to practice compassion, kindness, joy. If you can have joy for other people, it's a natural thing. Right? It's a very natural thing. But sometimes someone is happy, but you naturally feel jealous or upset. Right? If feelings like this arise, understand what is pushing it. Why is it there? It's ego rearing its head. It should be about me. Look at what is going on inside. Look at what are the thinking, different thoughts, different feelings are coming up. Use that as a way of practicing. Then when you work through and penetrate through that, then it becomes natural for you to feel joy for other people. That's not about forcing. It comes with your practice of your awareness, of getting rid of greed, getting rid of hatred, getting rid of this delusion or not understanding of how it works. And the most important thing, equanimity. This is the last one. When I spoke about equanimity, and the very surface level is about whatever happens externally, I should still be calm. But when things happen internally, when things come up, right? A lot of us in modern day life, I think, we go through life running from one thing to another, because we are not comfortable sitting with ourselves. Right? I think in modern daily life, again, myself as an example, I'm so busy, I have so much work, right? I'm doing a double doctorate right now. Right? So much work. And suddenly when I have time, I sit down. It's like, oh, I feel lost. Ooh. Okay, go and check email. Right? After email, oh gosh, let's do this, let's do that. You're always on the need to be on the move. And when you say suddenly sit down, just sit for a while, we find that we are not very comfortable just sitting quietly with ourselves. We don't know how to sit with ourselves. Right? I always like to cite this example. We have an appointment with someone else at 3 o'clock. We arrive at 2:50. Okay, still early. So technically we can't ring them to chase them up yet. unless it's 3:05, right? So there, shouldn't have come this early. So stupid standing here, right? So what do? You pace around, take out your mobile phone, check messages, no messages. Check previous messages. Right? Oh, previous messages, you scroll down everything. Check sent messages. You're just trying to engage, trying to have something to do. Constantly on the go. Right? And then you check your old pictures and this and that. Oh, you finish your mobile phone. Ah, still got a few minutes left. What to do? What to do? I caught myself doing that a few years ago. Right? And again, whenever I relate this story, I try to change. I said, okay, it's alright. Just sit with yourself. What are you feeling right now? What's going through? Just being aware, even with your breathing, your posture, just coming back to yourself. I thought I was doing quite well, until one day I was waiting for another friend. I said, I'm doing quite well. I had my hands in my pocket. I see, I'm not checking my mobile phone, hands in the pocket. I'm standing here quite comfortable. But then when I turned my awareness inside, I was actually jiggling my key. I was still restless. My hands were in the pocket, but they were still jiggling the key in there. Right? You're still restless. And I think modern day people, because of how life is designed around us probably, we go run from one thing to another. Or even in the bus. You see in the bus? iPod. I have a little book. It's constantly there. Right? That's perfectly fine. It's only when we can't put down that book and remove that iPod and just sit. I think many of us can't do that. Many of us aren't very comfortable with that. Because we have forgotten how to just be. Just to come back with ourselves. We could be equanimous towards things that are happening outside and remind ourselves to be calm. But when everything is calm outside, then when it's only inside that's happening, we're like, oh goodness, this is bad. Are you able to maintain that equanimity, that balanced state of mind with the different things that come up within you? Well, that is more important. And that is the important point of coming together with awareness, mindfulness, what's happening in here? Why am I feeling even this restless? The ability to see deep down. Like I say, it's probably the plight of modern day life that we've forgotten to... Yes?
Just when you're being mindful and you're noticing the things that come up, whether it be emotions or thoughts, and you don't judge them and you don't analyze them and you allow them to pass, when do you spend time to, say, you mentioned jealousy and envy or... when would you start to analyze, or where in your practice would you allow yourself time to analyze that, since in your mindfulness you're not allowing yourself to judge or analyze it? Do you set time apart for that?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. That's a good question. I think there are a few things here. Mindfulness is the awareness of sitting with it. Right? Things come up. You're aware of it. Okay? And usually in this process we're aware of it, but not always aware of it. You're aware of it coming out, our mindfulness renders, comes back. You see bits and pieces, snippets of things happening. But as we are able to sustain our awareness more and more about this body and mind phenomena, then we are starting to able to see its continuous process. We don't need to specifically go and think about, what has happened and what not. It's just ability to stay with it. That's the first part. That is that awareness. And even that, everyone finds it so difficult. Like I say, be aware of your breath. 1-2 breath, poof, the mind goes away. Right? Or mindful of anything, even your anger. Even if it comes up, you're aware anger has arisen. Anger is there. It goes on and off. It is trying to train your mind to just sit with it. If the more you're able to sit with it, you're starting to see how it comes up, how it changes, how it drops away. You're not specifically analyzing it, but by paying close attention to it, you're seeing the entire scene. And by seeing the entire scene, that is understanding. That is wisdom. Seeing how things come together. I'm not sure whether you've had any lectures on dependent origination. Right, maybe next semester. How you see that from the contact point, how feeling arises, how attachment clinging arises, and how that causes tension in your mental, your emotional difficulties or tension there, and how it drops away. The ability to see how that flows. That itself, that knowledge and understanding itself is not so easy as we think. At the conceptual level, we can imagine that. But to see it clearly for yourself, how this is happening, that requires very strong mindfulness and awareness. And your work is just to continuously maintain and sustain your awareness. Right? There's therefore no such a time as I'm thinking about my emotions or I'm processing it right now. You're just aware as it comes up. Because as it comes up, previously it pushes you. Now if you're just aware of it, it comes up, you're seeing it. It starts to change, it flips and whatnot, it does its thing, it does its dance, and then it goes away. Now you're starting to see how it happens. So you're already starting to have this space in between. Right? And you're starting to see how things change. And with this, you're less affected by it. Anger will still arise. But anger doesn't play on so much. In the past, anger arises, then you give it more fuel. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's so late. It's so terrible, this and that. It flares on. It goes on more and more. This is what, in modern psychological terms, we call rumination. It goes on and on and on and on. But now as it arises, as you just see it, okay, anger, right, okay, it will eventually cease and go away. Just seeing that process itself, that takes time to build towards that level of awareness. Right, and that understanding itself will keep changing. You're starting to be able to have more and more space in between that thing happening. Right, whatever emotion it is, it could be anger, jealousy, greed, hatred, disappointment, the whole spectrum of different habitual patterns. But it being able to just sit with them, that itself is a very important tool to have.
So you don't actually hold on to it to analyze it?
No. Because
you just observe it as it comes and goes.
Yeah.
And in that way you're actually becoming familiar with your own pattern.
Yeah. That's why in the training of establishing mindfulness or establishing or building awareness, the Buddha said, your work is to see. If a pleasant state of mind arises, you're very aware a pleasant state of mind has arisen. If it's a negative state of mind that has arisen, you're very clear that a negative state of mind has arisen. He doesn't say choose. Only make sure that you have kind thoughts only. The Buddha never said that. He says that be very clear of whatever is happening at the body and the mind phenomena. And that's why he said there are four things. Your body, your feelings, your mind, and your mental objects that you have to be very clear on. That's how you build your awareness. And eventually, as you build more and more awareness, these things affect you less. And you're able to just see it for how it is. And then you cut off that so much more. And as a practice of that, you're getting rid of greed and hatred, which is, in fact, what is obstructing us from having love, kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. When we get rid of these things, it becomes natural. It's not forced anymore. It becomes a fountain of kindness, joy, compassion for others that comes out very naturally. And that is why it is seen also as a fruit of the practice. But what practice? The practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. The practice of establishing your ethics, mastery of your mind, and then establishing proper wisdom, clear wisdom. And when your practice matures in that, this becomes very natural. Right, and then you can really be very kind. The more you practice that, the easier it is to be kind towards others. The easier it is to hear the suffering of others, they say. Because you have been through it yourself. Previously, your compassion may be, I'm the strong one. You're the one in difficulty. I'm helping you, right? This is exaggerating. But sometimes this is what is going on in our head. Right? Oh, you so poor thing. You are so sad. You are glow. I'm here helping you come up. Right? Sometimes there's this ego that's happening at the back of our mind if you're not careful with just practicing compassion for compassion. When we have the ability and awareness to see that there's this judgment, then we start to change. Okay, this is not right. Okay, or you're just sitting with it, what is coming up. But when you are reducing your own ego, working through your compassion, working through your greed, your hatred, you know that, in fact, we are not that different. I have my issues, I know. You have your pain. I have times where I feel that as though I can't control myself. I have so much hatred. Therefore, when I see that you are like that, I can feel for you. It becomes a softer. It's not so much out of ego. It's not so much that I'm so much better than you. In fact, I feel for you because, in fact, we are not that much different. The manifestation of it may be different. The way you show your anger and the way I show my anger may be different. But the common denominator is we have these tendencies. And then real compassion opens up more and more. right? And as you take away greed, take away hatred, then you become softer and softer. And that is important. That's why I say the four immeasurables could be a way of practicing. You could keep on reminding yourself to have love, kindness, compassion, joy, and all that. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's important that we also not lose the big picture. How are we going to approach this at the larger level? What is our main thing, our primary aim here? What is our primary tool? It's that of awareness, that of mindfulness. Without knowing what's happening inside, we may be having so much judgment, so much ego, when we're showing acts of kindness that we don't even know ourselves. When we're trying to show compassion towards others, there's so much me, you. Right? When we're showing loving kindness, in fact, we are choosing. A strong person hits a weak person. Right? It's easy for us to show kindness and love and care towards the weaker person. But how about the other person? The one who is harming the weaker one. Naturally, we'll just say, oh, that's a poor person. Oh, that's such a terrible person. Where is our real kindness, our real compassion? It is when we can see that, oh, it takes so much hatred for that person to cause that much harm to the weaker one. Then we will have equal levels of kindness and compassion for both of them. And this takes practice. This is not something that we can sort of, you know, train our mind to be. So I say, oh, no, no, no. I hate that person, but no, I shouldn't. I should show kindness. It doesn't work that way. It's only when you can see through yourself, ah, this is what greed is. This is what hatred feels like. This is what how it is you're seeing it for what it is. Then you can relate. You can see other people, how they are suffering in their process, in their life. And then that opens up yourself for then what is more, a purer form of compassion, a purer form of kindness. Now when we look at how we actually practice, the implications of practice is this. Personally, I find that it's important for us to continuously practice our mindfulness, our awareness, right? The Eightfold Path, that should be the main practice, right? Live an ethical life, moral life, right? Learn to master your mind, gain mastery over your mind. This is important. Start to investigate towards this body and mind phenomena. This is very, very important. This should be always the primary practice. Right? If you continue going down this path, doing these things, then naturally the positive and beautiful states of mind will arise. You're purifying your mind. The purification process is purifying your mind from greed, from hatred, from all these negative habitual patterns. When the purification happens, these states will keep growing by itself. It's natural. So that should always remain your main practice. And because we don't live in isolation, we have to deal with other people day in and day out, right? Sometimes because the purification process is not so well advanced yet, we need reminders in our lives to be kind, to be compassionate, right? We encourage ourselves to be kind, to be compassionate towards others. That's good, but the primary aim is the Noble Eightfold Path. And when you encourage yourself to be kind, when you try, and then you see what comes up, is judgment coming up? Is hatred coming up? Use that as a way of understanding yourself. When I, there's a one of the Dharma teachers that you may have met in the past, Jim Teo. I do some joint teachings with him at Buddhist Library and Buddhist Council. He helps out at this Ashfield Uniting Church once in a month, whereby they serve food for homeless people, pretty much. And it's an open door. Whoever just comes, we offer food. Right, free food on a Saturday morning. Right, so there was once I went there. Before going there, he said, "Just take this chance." He is also a mindfulness and vipassana practitioner. Right, that's the practice of mindfulness, of the meditative or cultivation of awareness and mindfulness. So he was that was his main practice. So he said, "It's very good. You are doing something that's of kindness and compassion towards others. But as you are doing this, be aware of what's happening in your mind. See what comes up. You will see maybe judgment or whatever comes up. Just be open to it. As you're trying to show kindness, see what comes up." So I went, oh, it should be easy, right? You're there, you're doing a good deed, Saturday morning, right? Can't be better than than that. So you go there, okay, I think it was about 11 o'clock, so before that, everyone's ready, okay, I was in charge of milk, right? Milk to add to tea. So I was like, okay, milk. So 11 o'clock, the door opens, and then you see people walking by. I'm just standing there, it's like, then you hear your mind chattering, ooh, that one, ooh, he's pretty well dressed, why is he here? Oh, that one, oh, bring the whole family here. Wow. Oh, they even brought plastic bags to bring some food back. All this chattering was going on in my head. Right? And there I was trying to show kindness and compassion. But there was all this judgment going on. Right? If I didn't have that, I would just be chattering away in turn. Right? And then there was one person who came out, okay, they want milk, okay, for their tea, and all right, you pour milk, you serve them, right? And then there's this lady who kept coming out for I want just milk. Right, nothing else, just give me the whole cup of milk. Alright, first time, then she went back. And I came back again, I want milk. It's like, oh, alright, milk. Right. Third time again, wow, you're taking away a lot of milk, you know? And you're like, but then you almost forget that you're there to give out milk, right? And then you're like, but, you know, there's this struggle there. Like, come on, this milk is for you to add with tea. Right? You shouldn't come with an empty cup. Let's put some water, at least pretend or something. But you're like, you want milk after milk. And there's all these judgments start to come up. Right? Again, if you're not careful with this, we feel that we are being kind, we're being compassionate. But there's all this background noise that's going on. That's why I say it's very important to have the awareness and clarity of the mind. That if that is your main practice, you're always online as to what is happening inside. So when you have chances and opportunities to show acts of kindness, compassion, you use that as the training ground. Right? In that process, what is holding you back? Is it you? Is it them? Or what is happening there? Then you can start to see what is it that happens at the mind and body level. Right? Why am I so irritated? Right? All these things to be given out anyway. But why am I so having so much judgment? So that was a very... Yep?
Sorry, but there was obviously a good reason for. Because you had maybe certain, you know, say 2 or 3 liter milk, and you want to, you know, put that in the coffee or in the tea. So obviously there was a good reason why you think like that. So you, in the end, how did you solve the problem?
In the end, I was still quite grouchy, I must say. And then in the end, I went to speak with Jim about this. And then he said, our work here is just to give whoever comes by, right? And when you start picking and choosing, right, I can't really remember what his words were, but this is a lesson I learned. When you start picking and choosing, then you have this criteria, that criteria, then you start to measure up so much. We give as much as we can at that time, but this food and all was supposed to be given out anyway, right? And just showing this kindness to that person, you don't know what effect or what seeds you are planting towards this person. This person may be going through life being very needy. You're going to places and you're being rejected all the time. And suddenly this person comes to a place whereby you're just holding them. Right? And whether consciously or not, the person does feel the difference. Right? And firstly, all these things are to be given out anyway. Right? So your work there is just to give, right? If you start to measure, it's going to be quite difficult. And at the person's level also, some things will change. This is how you relate to other people, right? If in a separate context whereby, okay, there's limit or stop or whatever, yes, you have to use your wisdom. You have to use your understanding, right? But when you have all this irritation and whatnot, I don't think you can make a very clear and good decision of how you relate to others. Right? You may be, are you really saving that milk for others, or are you just hiding this milk from them because you feel that they are very irritable? All these things start to be more intricate, and as you start to look into your mind, sometimes the sort of surface level is not as simple as that. There is more to it, right?
You let go and say, look, what's gone is gone.
Yeah, in that sense, you give milk, yeah. And the same goes for all the food we have there anyway. That was the policy that was set there. If you're early, you come, we give. We finish giving, that's it. Right? And there I was holding on to this 2 liter milk. And because that was clouded by my own irritation. As when we start seeing these things in our daily life, then we refine this sense of softness of the heart, this loving nature, this compassion. compassion and love and kindness cannot exist without the wisdom. If not, it's blind in many sense. Right? You're not even aware of what's happening. Certain people give donation. Then they have to write these huge names on the pillar. Right? Sometimes certain places I go, wow, such beautiful buildings. But they've got all these names everywhere. Right? This pillar was donated by who? This was donated by who? Wow, there are more names here than Buddha statues. So the monasteries you go, right, there's one Buddha, but you know, how many hundreds of names there? It's important for them to see, so every time they go to the monastery, they pay the respect to the Buddha and they say, wow, that's my name. So they polish their ego once. Second time they bow, they see their name again. Right? What are we doing? Why don't we stop ourselves? What are we doing in our practice of love and kindness and giving? If you're not being careful, that's when our greed and hatred takes over. And then you're going the other direction. That's why I say in this talk, I wasn't going to focus so much. Because you guys know what are the positive qualities. But what I'm talking about are the risk factors that are there. When you just look at kindness for kindness, compassion for compassion. It's important to always have the primary practice of awareness and mindfulness in our spiritual path. If not, our kindness and compassion will be very blunt. Right? It doesn't shine forth as clearly. And that's why, if that message goes through today, my job here is done. And like I say, the best thing is to practice both together. We haven't reached the most advanced stages of the mind whereby we can naturally feel love and kindness. We can remind ourselves. But all the time, we have to be aware of what's happening in here. Without this, what is outside could be a bit wobbly. When we're always grounded and centered here, knowing what's happening here, then what we do towards others becomes powerful, pure, clear, and what the Buddha wanted us to do. Okay? Any questions?
I have a comment on the story about the moon. I think many times whenever you're giving help to someone, not just people who are homeless or disadvantaged, people underestimate the independence of the other. You know, that person has arrived to decide if they want to have tea or they want to have milk, and it's their taste. So many other times they don't have the choice, they don't have the people kind of cut that right off because they are on the street or they look a certain way. They have the independence to make that choice. So I was at a similar thing, giving out food, and we were giving out food and people had cooked food, and it was a lot of Indian people, so there was a lot of curry and rice. And we gave one box to the person, and he wanted another box. And the dog had it. And everyone was like, my God, he's giving the curry and rice to the dog. Of course, it's his choice. His dog needs some food too. And if he's going to use it, then they have to have you have to accord someone the right to choose that.
And sometimes that dog is dearer to them than anyone else in the entire world. Right? They may feel more love and kindness towards the dog, much more than you can ever imagine yourself towards a dog. Right? Who are we to judge sometimes? Right? But when we are able to hold ourselves back and see, hang on, what is happening? You may still say, but if you're able to catch yourself and say, hey, hang on, what's happening there? At that moment, let's pause for a bit, rewind a bit even, right? See what's actually happening. What's boiling inside? This is important. These are our own vulnerabilities, our own blocks or obstacles towards kindness. And yeah, I agree. Sometimes you will think, oh, but really, it's giving. And if you're really Buddhist, dog is a being, right? It's got feelings. It's got a mind. It can think, right? And it's important to feed the dog too. So thank you for sharing that. Questions? Comments? Complaints? And I think at the end of the day, I used to be in Dharma talks, right? And I find that, wow, 2 hours, that's just about right. But the more that I practice, right, the more I find that the talk part should be lesser and lesser, and the actual practice part should be more and more. But I think it's important for us always to know where we are heading, to know why we are here. What is the ultimate objective, the aim of practicing the path? And it's there's no obligation, it's not compulsory for everyone. But if you choose the Buddha's path, then know why you're choosing the Buddha's path. Know what is it about? What is the main thing? Right? I always say don't forget what the main dish is here. Don't swap the entree for the main dish. Right? And sometimes like these acts of kindness and stuff, that's very important. That forms part of the entire cuisine, but the main dish should always be mindfulness. Practice of that. Right? Getting rid of your tendencies of greed or tendencies of hatred. That is very important. Without that, everything is just a temporary fix. It has its place, yes. Some teachers say that, okay, do metta meditation first. Right? Meditation of irradiating loving kindness. Because they know that your mind may not be settled enough. You do that first. But ultimately, they'll say, okay, now start observing mind and body phenomena. After doing that, go back to a bit of metta. But always we have to know why we are doing each thing. That has to be very clear. Then our spiritual path becomes something that we own. Our life won't be so separate. You know, the best Buddhist teachers that I've come across, right, are the most honest people. They are the type who come and say, don't expect me to be perfect. Right? And I find that, wow, that statement alone is very powerful. They are so aware of themselves, knowing that I'm not perfect. I'm not trying to pretend to be. And being able to say that, they're very much in tune. They know that they have this anger coming out and whatnot. But they're working through that work in progress. Work in progress is fine. We don't expect everyone to have reached full enlightenment or liberation yet. But working through these issues, we know where we are putting our effort. That's a very important thing. Any comments? Yep.
I'm aware that I've attended a 10-day Vipassana course before.
Yep.
I'd like your personal opinion on it.
Mm-hmm. What about it?
Like the how it strengthened your thought or changes your thought about Buddhism.
Like I say, previously when I started coming across Buddhist teachings is I read a lot of books, right? I grew up from a family whereby we are so-called nominal Buddhists. So we do all the prayers and the rites and rituals without saying, why are we burning all these things? So I started to ask a lot of questions, right? And probably confuse a lot of people in asking, and then my mom would be like, yeah, why? But anyway, going through that, then I read a lot of books and then I went to different centers and learned from different teachers. But initially it was all the theory. Right, Four Noble Truths, what they are, I can tell you. Eightfold Path, what it is. Right, all these theories. Like, okay, good. So what do I have to do? Right, what is the practical level? Then they say, okay, try to be. Like I say, some teachers say, maybe you have to show kindness, you have to show compassion. Okay, I try to do that, and then I get a bit stuck there. Right, and then you should say, oh, things are impermanent, things are changing. Right, that's just a reality of life. Okay, yes. Right, you get that in your head, but that doesn't transform into real understanding. And the course that you're talking about is based on mindfulness, right? Awareness, vipassana, right? And that I find that with all this theory, right, it sort of makes it all come alive for me. Because when the Buddha said in life there's suffering, it's important for you to understand, to see what is the cause of suffering, and to see the path to come out of that. And this is the training. So when the training bit in the past, I did the morality part, okay. Right, for the mastery of the mind, some people say use chanting or whatnot, that's fine. But ultimately, wisdom seems to be just in the books. Right, or there's Four Noble Truths and whatnot. But you don't really live it, you don't really see it. Right? And it says that the Buddha's path is about getting rid of greed and the hatred. When we have to try to do something, when I'm asking teachers for, okay, what should I do? Oh, you can do some prayers, you can do some chanting or whatever. I find that, okay, that's good in reinforcing what I need to do, but you know, reading the manual is not entirely doing what the manual says, if you understand what I mean. So you're constantly reading the manual, okay, you're very good at the manual, you can even debate with other people what the manual is about. But what that experience allowed me to go into retreat and doing mindfulness practice, that brings everything alive. What is suffering here immediately? Why is greed coming up? When is hatred coming up? How do I deal with these things? How do I sit with it? How do I inspect it as it comes out and goes away? What is the nature of it? Is it changing? Do I own it? Do I have control over it? So I'm starting to experience the actual teachings in a day-to-day life. And then I started to be able to integrate that into my daily life. Previously, I'm like the scholarly Buddhist and the normal me. right? Who has all my whole thing, greed, hatred, and whatnot, right? And now I'm starting to, in my daily life, start to bring this into it, because you are starting to have this awareness. You are being taught how to build your awareness, how to cultivate this awareness, how to see it, right? Like I say, the grass is coming up. You're seeing what the grass is about. You see where the roots grow. But by understanding this, then, okay, it's easy. You have to take it off like that. Previously, all my books are like books upon books of upon this grass. Right? By grass, I mean all these, let's say, anger, defilements, or negative patterns. All one thing upon another, sort of just putting on top of it, stopping it. But then you're not clearing it from the deep levels of your mind. And the only way of us doing that is when we can see it. We can't fight something, or we can't transcend something without fully understanding it. We can only transcend something when we fully understand it. And that wisdom takes time to ripen. Right? There's no point forcing ourselves, oh, attachment is bad, we should detach. It's not about that. It's when your understanding is ripe enough and stable enough, you just know, okay, there's no point holding it so hard. Let it go. Or you let go a little. Again, I'm far, far from perfect. But at least working and putting your effort in that direction. As much as you do, as much as you practice, you immediately gain. There's no use telling you there's a past life, there's a beautiful place out there, and you may go there if you're lucky. Right? Not very good deal, right? But Dharma is always something that you practice now. As much as you practice, you should reap the benefits of it. If you don't find that, change, something is not right. Discuss with somebody. Go and see certain guides or certain teachers. Something is not doing right. Or are you missing the big picture here? If you feel that in your practice and the cultivation of Dharma, nothing changes in your life, I say don't waste your time with that practice. Change it. Tweak it. Find out what's going on. And don't forget the big picture. How you approach these things. So I hope that sort of answers your question. Other questions? Yeah.
Could you differentiate between, in terms of beauty of mind, between a Nobel Peace Prize winner, a spiritual leader, or an artist? Do you see a difference in the beauty of the mind there, or is that just too exterior?
I think that's too abstract. Each individuals are quite different. As I can only say that if a person is as a product of whatever the way he lives his life is really peaceful and happy for himself and the people around him, that is the more important gauge than anything else. You can have all this knowledge in the world, right? But you can be just as miserable. You can have a lot of knowledge in the right places, then that creates liberation, then that's different. There was once, there's this story that one of the, probably in our modern times, our greatest Vipassana teachers, Goenka, right? A few of you will be very familiar with him. He, in his retreat, he mentioned this story whereby there are these scientists who came to learn from his teacher, was in Burma, right? And these scientists, when they went to learn from him, then they realized that Ubakin was the one who told them that there's this scientist who is able to measure. No, actually, sorry, let me start again. It was Goenka himself, right? This is a very great Vipassana teacher, and he's currently residing in India, still around. Right, there are many Westerners who come and learn from him. And during one of his discourses, he says that the Buddha in the past said that within the blink of an eye, the material body changes how many times, right? So many, 10 to the power of like 23 times or something like that. That's what the Buddha was able to see at the physical level, right? Some of these scientists from the West came, right, to learn from him. And then during his discourse, he said that, and there's also a scientist now in the West who has proven, based on his measurements and instruments, that it is true that matter, or quarks or whatever, the amount of vibration in it is 10 upon how many, 10 to 23 times or whatever. There was a measurement there. So both of them, in fact, came to the same realization. Right? This person won a Nobel Prize for having that instrument and measuring the vibration of matter. Now, some of your physics people, you may know, who and what these instruments are. I'm not totally trained in that at all, so I can only give you a brief. But the Buddha also saw that within a blink of an eye, or within a snap of a finger, right, the matter has changed trillions of times. So very similar. Both came to very similar conclusions, right? And the Buddha, as a result of seeing that, not just that, but one of his insights is that, seeing the body, how it changes, gained liberation. He was such a peaceful and happy person, right? Purity of the mind, very calm, full of love, full of kindness. So when these students from the West came and learned from Goenka, they went back because they knew that there's this university, so it was within them. Then they went to see who this person was. Right? There's this scientist who actually invented this instrument. And when we went to see him, that they realized that he was such a miserable person. Right? All his relationships with the people around him was just no good. Right? He was very smart. Right? Terrific, beautiful mind in the intellectual sense, that you'd be able to have come out with such an instrument to measure matter. But with the same knowledge, it doesn't create any liberation. Your life is still very, very miserable. If I compare the two, I think I would like to be more like the Buddha side rather than the scientist side, although you have the same knowledge. So it's hard to say. But what I feel is that at the end of the day is how we transform our life. If our life is positive, it's naturally with love, compassion, there's less greed, less hatred, living more a peaceful life, then I think that is the more important thing. And that is where the real beauty of the mind lies. That's from my own perspective anyway. Some people may disagree, but it's an individual choice. So I hope that, I can't really answer with regards to an artist or a scientist or what, but that's what I think. Other questions?